Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
All right. Got some action. Very exciting. Let's welcome to the stage my friend, Marcus.
I cannot hear you.
You can't? No hearing?
Hold on. That might be my settings. I do have mic. Okay, yeah, here we go. All right, try it again.
Can you hear me?
Yes, okay. It had my microphone as my speakers. That's what was going on.
Yeah.
You
want my volume not coming back into your microphone. You want the sound from your computer not to go back into the microphone. Look at you. You got the white. I got the black.
I know, right?
I've even put on a tie so you wouldn't judge me again.
Oh, fantastic.
You're just so full of judgment, as we all know.
I'm never silently judging people constantly.
I know that.
Thanks for getting dressed up. This is exciting. It's Easter Sunday. Nice to be hanging out with you.
Likewise,
Yeah, thanks for the patience while I worked out the technical difficulties, but we're here. We're ready to go.
It is a little tricky when you first do it, when you first do anything.
It's true. So,
We'll have to check out the recording later and see if it's jolty or anything like that and see how the levels are. It should work. I learned how to use OBS, and the problem is it's an older version, so it can crash. And it's like, you could use that, but then risk it crashing when you have like a panel of 3-4 people on, and then that's not worth it. So it might just be
better
to use the up-to-date software like this. So. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
It looks good. I mean, we used StreamYard when I went live with Angela, and that worked out fine. So seems to be a good program. I love the graphic you have going on in the background. That's hypnotic. I could just stare at that all day. So
nice. Yeah, we can get a better look at it there. Yeah, I like that one.
Cool. All right. So what do you want to chat about?
I don't know. I thought we would start with a prayer.
Yes. Please.
We'll do bibliomancy. So say when, and then I'll stop.
Nah.
All right. Ooh, we got, so this is from Evelyn Underhill's book of private prayers she would use for leading retreats. It was only recently discovered and published by someone who did a professor in Australia who did her doctorate on Underhill's teacher, Baron von Hugel. So this prayer we stopped on is called Sacrifice. This is mostly her original prayers, but some are famous ones that she liked or just ones from other people. And this is one of those. Sacrifice. O God, you have set us in the train of many martyrs and holy people and given us as author and finisher of our faith, one who offered himself up a living and dying sacrifice. We are not our own, but yours. Freely may we crucify our shrinking will, surrender ourselves to the uttermost claims of your spirit and seek no peace but in harmony with you. Amen.
Amen.
That's by a fellow named James Martineau, who I'm not familiar with. So, Evelyn Underhill's little private prayer book from her later years.
Yeah. Well, that's some excellent bibliomancy, extremely appropriate for Easter Sunday. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I don't see any comments, but theoretically people should be able to make comments wherever we're streaming. So do you know where we're streaming right now?
No, I know. I was rushing
we're
to get
streaming that. On YouTube
mm-hmm.
and on my Facebook page for Magic Without Fears.
Nice.
And, of course, on the world's most favorite platform ever created, X.
All good vibes over there. Yes.
I just saw the option to stream on it, and I don't use X at all.
There you go.
Sometimes I click buttons to share things on it just for shits and giggles, but yeah. But we might be streaming on X. So, you know, maybe there are people that spend a lot of, that's like their only social media thing. And I'm sure there's occultists who are like that. So they might find us and be like, oh, this is neat. It is sort of neat. We may as well enjoy this technology while we have it. I mean, like, it's one of the few perks of the world. I hear more and more you know, thought leaders or mm-hmm. not guru types, but people with sway about what, you know, life, I guess you might call mm-hmm. them real life coaches, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to the usual type that you meet at the bar mm-hmm. while their wife's at work. I met a bunch of those.
Really?
When I worked in bars. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because they never had any work to do. It was like a job that they could do while living off their wives. Because, you know, if one person makes like crazy more money than the other person,
well, it's
like there's no point in doing some totally garbage job.
Oh, that's so funny.
Right. You wouldn't do a job that pays 30 grand a year if your spouse makes 250. Right, you just wouldn't do it. So you become a life coach and work from home or from the bar. So I met some of those types of people, and it was interesting. Wow. They really were sort of lost in life and didn't know what to do with themselves.
Oh, isn't that like the human condition? Oh, I can't figure out this problem for myself. Wait, I'll help everyone else figure out this problem for themselves first, and then I'll be the last one to receive help. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah.
Oh, this is cool.
Yeah, I like this layout.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And yeah, I'll actually have a new camera soon. So yeah, time to upgrade that. I got away with the built-in one as long as I could because, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many books to buy. But yeah, how do we get to talking about life coaching? Jesus.
Well, there was an occult topic that I thought of for today's chat. The role of faith and magic. How much you need to believe. Yeah, yeah. This is interesting for me because my background comes from exploring occultism as an atheist, thinking it would all be just psychological, and then being very disappointed at how undeniably real it was and the changes that were happening to me in my life. And so I went into it with just concentration and suspension of disbelief. And so faith was never like a part of my practice for a long time. I've since come to appreciate it as much in my own life and, you know, different things that I'm doing as much as anything that I do with magic. But how has faith played a role in your magic, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think faith is very important. I actually wrote an article on it when I was in Practicus for the Beak, our Temple Tehuti newsletter, and mm-hmm. it was a good one. People liked it, I guess, because I think the danger is worrying too much sometimes in results, especially, and mm-hmm. if it's a more theurgic approach to allow your faith to be guiding your activities for the sake of transformation, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard. Faith is a tricky one when you talk about, like, you know, sorcery or people trying to do magic, I think, to cause change. Because, like, what's the role of faith in that? If you look at magic from that more mechanistic point of view of success or failure, right? I think it's harder. What do you think?
Oh, well, a lot of people really advocate faith as being necessary for the magic to even work in the first place. They have to have absolute faith in the spirits you're working in. They have to have absolute faith in the efficacy of your magic practice. And that's never been my experience, but it's interesting to see that perspective. And I understand it, because certainly if you spend all of your time second-guessing yourself and doubting and worrying about, oh, is my magic going to work or not? Like, that's definitely dividing your unity of purpose, dividing your will. It's not going to be as powerful as just concentrating on, yes, this is going to happen. It's going to get done. But what I found is that I need unity of purpose and concentration during the ritual. I mean, that can, for some people, that does look like faith, but for me, it just felt like concentration. But during the rest of the time, I'd just be thinking, and sometimes I'd be skeptical, and sometimes I'd think, maybe I need to do more magic for this, or maybe I need to do a different kind of ritual, or maybe that wasn't the best ritual. Maybe I need to do that better. And so I found those thoughts to be more helpful. But I definitely believe that from a theurgic standpoint, it becomes more relevant in terms of just not just having unity of purpose, but also trusting that the spirits that you're working with are wiser than you. When you're working with angels, trusting that, you know, whatever result that you're trying to manifest, will only happen if it's in some accordance with the divine will. And that if it doesn't happen, there's a deeper reason for that. And that your job is then to understand that and to interpret what happened as a result of your magic and use that to further your progress rather than just expecting to, you know, kick the soda machine until your soda comes out. So.
And, you know, it does, faith does bring up some interesting points when you look into some of the grimoires, especially, right? Mm-hmm. Like with the mm-hmm. Arbitel, yeah. Right? The Arbitel is really got a very strange mixture of stuff in it with the pagan-esque, archon-esque Olympic spirits, but then this very Calvinist theology. And if you know much about Calvinist theology, you know that the role of faith and even fate, if you want to call predestination fate, plays an interesting role. So if you look at it from that perspective, right, the magic of the Arbitel is very much a natural outflowing of proper alignment and relationship of yourself with God, right? In the mm-hmm. Arbitel, if you are aligned with God and you set yourself up in this harmony with God in nature and mm-hmm. do these operations at sunrise on the right day, then mm-hmm. you get to interact with these spirits who are Olympic for some reason. Really, I don't think anyone has figured out yet. There's some good theories and some good research done by people and some wild books written. I recently got you might hear this my Easter gift.
Michael.
My Easter peanuts fall down. So if you hear a noise, don't mind it. Mm. Okay. So this is a wild book. A friend in England turned me on to by Sor ZSD23. Right, and it's called The Seal of Secrets of the World, and it's one magician's working with the Arbitel. So, you know, you have some really interesting texts that have come out over time. This is the revised second edition. Apparently it quotes Dr. Burns and them a lot, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Nice. You look at it from that point of view, faith is understanding your destination, the destination of your soul that has been determined by God and is redetermined regularly, and that's the fun part of Calvinist theology prior to Zwingli, where, you know, well, because if you do something bad, then clearly, you know, your faith wasn't ever correct. Right. That's a fun one. But it's interesting that alignment of faith with God and nature in the Arbitel, allowing spirit communications to come from there. And in the Arbitel, remember, right, the spirits don't speak to you in like a scryy mm-hmm. Q&A format like we often see in the Trithemian method, right? There's these set questions that Trithemius has for asking mm-hmm. spirits, and you see those echoed all through modern magical traditions, including the Golden Dawn. Someone here is talking about Golden Dawn. That's that same formula of Q&A is there, but you also see this sort of direct input method of, hey, occult perspectives, good to see you, man. Little brother Mason, who his crew talk a lot about the Kleepote man. There's like someone's like, I'm invoking Thaumiel and it's been great, and it's like, more power to you.
Wow.
I hopefully you don't walk into a street after working with the Kleepote, but yeah, the Kleepote are there. We can talk about the Kleepote later. Actually, we had an interesting experience with a couple of them last operation, and that was fun. Of course, my view on them and take on them is different than you see in the Clifothic crowd in community. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But where were we? So, yeah, mm-hmm. the spirits of the Arbitel don't do this Q&A thing. They beam the knowledge directly into your brain, into your consciousness from the divine.
Cool. Yeah. That's an interesting perspective. Just a determination in general, because I've heard that from other occultists, especially those that have a more psychic proficiency and talent for prophecy. They see us as being free agents, but making all of our choices at once, but only viewing those choices one at a time through the present moment. So to them, it's all determined. We're just here to experience all of the choices we have actually already made with our own free will, which I don't fully align with that simply because all forms of determinism to me seem to rely on a level of certainty that nobody's ever demonstrated. Whether it's like scientific determinism or like prophetic psychic determinism, the idea that you could have 100% accuracy with predictions is very tempting. It's very powerful. But I've never seen anyone actually do it. And so I'm like, okay, if there's uncertainty anyway, why couldn't that uncertainty be coming from the fact that we're actually free and actually making choices like we seem to be experiencing? What prevents that from happening? So that tends to be where I fall on that line. But the idea of aligning yourself with divinity in order to is something that I really resonate with, just because I kind of stumbled into theurgy in some ways, despite working with angels and these other entities. When I first started magic, I was really interested in just like getting results. I felt like my life was really bad. I wanted to get some things to improve my life, and that worked. And then I kept doing it, and it kept working. And then I got interesting feedback where the things that I'd manifested were literally everything that I asked for, but I didn't like them. And that's one of the most fascinating results you can get with magic, is when you get exactly what you ask for and you hate it. And that really just points out you are the problem. You are the weak link in this chain. You need to improve yourself if you're going to have a better experience of life. And that to me is where theurgy and thaumaturgy, like manifestation and self-development, really go hand in hand, where a lot of times the things that you're trying to manifest will show up in such a way as to put a giant spotlight on the ways that you need to improve as a person. And that to me is where I found it helpful to just do both, and to realize that there are flaws in you that are not obvious. When you manifest, they become obvious. They become places and people and things and events in the world. And then you can realize that, and then realize you need to work on yourself, and then you can improve from that standpoint. So I feel like it's all at some level an alignment with divinity. It's just a matter of how direct you want that to be. Do you want to just concentrate on improving yourself, have faith that that'll be enough? Or do you want to get something practical to change and then parse the results of that to see see what you want to do in the future? So. Oh, I can't hear you. Oh, you muted. Frauder, you muted.
Yeah. It's exactly like the new light bulb I put in my bathroom, basically. As soon as you shine more light, you see more dirt. And you're like, oh, I never saw that before. I'm like, I need to get the cloth and essential oils out and get the wall there. Because, you know, the lights were dimmer because better for your eyes, I guess, or something. But you don't see as much dirt. So too little light is maybe mm-hmm. healthier. Less light is sometimes healthier for parts of us. But more light will let us see things we maybe didn't want to see.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think a gradual progress is good. I think this is where faith can really play a role, when you know that there's more to see, but you're not quite ready to see it. So rather than rending open the veil, Hierophant reversed, you want to incorporate a little bit at a time and trust that if something isn't happening, there's a good reason, and you don't want to know the reason. I mean, sometimes I've asked my spirits about something that I was really frustrated about and gotten an answer and gotten a really harsh answer that was really true. So it gives you forbearance to realize that some of the things that you're working on are just a little too big to take on all at once, and maybe just a little bit more illumination, not the full brightness, but a little bit more illumination and just working with what you have in front of you is enough. And I think there's a certain amount of faith that comes with that humility of just working on what you have in front of you, not being too overly ambitious or not asking for way more than you have.
And maybe the less light would be the hermit with the lamp going up the path of Yud from mm-hmm. Tiferet to Hesed, because the Hierophant is meant to rend the veil. Rending the veil is the technical term for what the Hierophant does. So that's not Hierophant reversed. Rending is the way is what you call parting the veil. That's just the technical term for it, is rending the veil.
I was thinking of the tarot, as far as the signification goes.
Yeah. That's all. Oh, yeah, I like it. It's fun.
Yeah, well, that's how I've always interpreted the Hierophant or the Papess in the original tarot. The idea of this person that holds the veil between spirit and matter, because mundane people aren't ready to know about the totality of what's going on in the spirit world behind the veil. And then that card reversed means letting open the floodgates, saying saying the quiet part out loud, revealing the really harsh truths of spirituality that people probably aren't ready to hear, but maybe need to hear it anyway. So
yeah, that's the cruelly adage of telling someone a truth they're not yet ready to hear, which, you know, can sound, you can interpret that phrase very arrogantly, of course, but that's not how it was meant, I'm sure. It was meant in the sense of, yeah, the Hierophant reverse, sort of sharing things that either the person, it's not relevant to them, not helpful to hear, and which is, you know, not doing your duty as a Hierophant, which is to you know, be help people prepare for the mysteries. Really, that's, I think, the biggest thing that the Golden Dawn interpretation of the Hierophant has to offer, in my opinion, is the tool of the path. The tool of the path of the Hierophant, because each path has a tool in the Golden Dawn. And the tool of the path of the Hierophant is preparation. And anyone out there who's ever been an actual Hierophant for GD initiations or anything of equivalent scale knows exactly why that's so important. Because everything you do up to that that office, fulfilling that role, is preparation for that role. And everything you do to make your job work in that role is preparation. Like every initiation does well or does poorly based on how much preparation you do. And I think that's where, especially for self-initiates out there, that lesson is so incredibly crucial if you want to have success, you know, journeying deep into the mysteries.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is something that I talk to about my clients all the time in terms of using magic as practice. And trying to, you know, build up to the level, sometimes using astral magic or visualization of magic to build up to the point that you can do the full ritual in person with your body, with all of your regalia, with whatever tools you're using with, and get it right because you've memorized it, because you've walked through it so many times. I think that's an incredible skill to have to allow you to concentrate fully, because this is another interesting thing. Magic, ceremonial magic, can be really occupying for the mind at first, because there are so many steps, there are so many details. But the more you learn it, the more your mind has a chance to wander again. And that's where you really need to build the concentration. Because if instead of letting your mind wander, you can just pour all of your concentration into actually doing the ritual, then you tend to get the best results. All right.
Certainly with some things, that's definitely the case, I think. I think there might be some exceptions in some forms of practice that I can think of, but and you know, when I got into magic, it was to change myself so I would have a better relationship to the world and to this life, whatever there was of it. And I didn't expect changes to really occur in my life. That was the surprise when I started doing Don Craig's book. After learning, I learned the LBRP from Rigardi's Tree of Life, and, like, you know, a very old edition that an AA member had left in our house when I lived in the OTO Oasis at age 10. Right, so some of the magic books got mixed up in my stuff. Probably because we rushed out there late in the middle of the night. My mom, like, hurried me and my sister out with the guy screaming at us, and just, he was a very, very bad man. And some of the magic books of the AA and Gnostic priestess lady Maria got mixed up in my stuff. And years later, when I was like 12, I found them. And yeah, Rigardi's Tree of Life's like, touch your forehead, say Ate, Ate, Malchus. And it was like, with the S pronunciation, Kesser Malchus. Yeah, the old Rigardi Tree of Life before it had the big Cicero editing job done on it. And so that was very not, it didn't do anything for me. It wasn't, Don Craig made it come more alive. But, and to the extent that changes did start to occur, the way I was treated by the world was a lot better very quickly. And I don't know why. I think that was just, yes, I believe it's the four archangels. being called around you every day makes a big difference. And whether you're tracing pentagrams or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Having some spiritual intermediary between you and the world to help that relationship get along really, really helps. And I love working with the archangels. So what did you have to say about the Clipote? I'm interested to get into that topic.
Oh, last operation, I was doing like one of the most arduous sort of techniques that can be done. And even then at a simplified version, because I was helping some others through it and learn it at a more basic level. Largely also to excite people as to see how far this can go and how far we do go with it. You might not think about it. So we did this really shortened version of one of the more advanced GD type of techniques and operations. And by shortened, I mean it was an hour and 20 minutes from when the beginning to the when we opened our eyes again. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where you can really encounter forces if you do it right. And usually when, you know, things show up, like the shells, right, it's because you're entering a new sphere, a new sphera. And as you enter the new sphera, sometimes you'll have doubts in your mind. You're going along a path or you're just going straight into the sphere and, you know, meditating and vibrating, creating these divine names and energies through the middle pillar and generating consciousness and elevating yourself and refining your sense of lightness as you go more and more into or out of your body. And then you'll have weird doubts come into your mind. Like, so as we were traveling from one sphere to the next sphere, I was doing it that way, which is sometimes fun, and especially in an educational environment, it's very helpful for students to see those different pathways you can take up the tree in work. And the doubt came into my mind right away, was like, no, this is the wrong path. You know, this is not the path that you think it is. You're wrong, and you're going to make a mistake. You're going to fuck up, and everyone's going to have a horrible... It's going to be bad. It's going to be bad, man. And it all just, right? And and I was like, oh, and I knew what this was, of course, because I knew this correspondence. I wasn't wrong. I wasn't wrong about it. And that's to all those people who don't like my approach, because they don't believe that anything should ever have to be memorized for any reason whatsoever, including Hebrew letters or names of spheres or angels. There's no reason to memorize anything if you have it in a book. If you have it in a book, it's the same thing as having it in your head. And anyone who says otherwise is a Nazi. And that's so I'm a Nazi for asking people to memorize Hebrew or the path names or angels or things like that. Whatever. But I knew I was right about what pathway I was going on and what names to call. But this voice was like, no, you don't. You're just full of pride. You know, it's like, that's the Clipote. That's the shell around the sephira. That's the husk interfering. And you need to know yourself well enough to transmute it. And of course, David Heimsmith has a great course on that I highly recommend. It's very intense and very fairly priced as well. So check out David Heimsmith's course on transmuting Clipote.
Beautiful.
There you go. So that's an example of encountering the Clipote in a basic minor way, right? Those things like, and was that the, you know, the sphere, was that the Clipote of Tiferet or Chesed, or the tunnel? Was it the tunnel of Yud? Was it the path demon of Yoda? You know, if you were wanting to go into that, if it was a solo working I was doing, I would have gone deeper into what those things might have been and learned a bit more about myself. But that's not, these things just needed to be transmuted and passed by with the help of spirits and angels. And that's it.
Totally. Well, it's also when you're doing magic with other people, you don't even know if it's yours. You know, you could have just been like doubt from someone else as your spheres of sensation tend to merge. That is, getting into the group. But that's also really interesting, going back to our discussion on faith, how that impurity can be challenging, can be causing you doubt, can be causing you to make rash decisions or even stop when you need to keep going. And this is something that I've experienced through ritual all the time of double checking, guessing, second guessing myself, thinking, oh, they're all going to laugh at me, or whatever the case may be. And one thing that magic has given me is a tremendous amount of faith in myself, not even faith that I'll get things right, just faith that I will improve. So everything that I'm doing, either it's right and I can continue succeeding, or it's wrong and I will learn. And that allows me to have a tremendous amount of commitment to whatever I happen to be doing in the moment, to where even if I have a nagging doubt of, oh, maybe this is all wrong, maybe they're all going to laugh at me. Well, if that happens, it's okay. I'll learn and I'll be sure to do better in the future and I won't have that problem anymore. And so I just have an extraordinary commitment to whatever I happen to be doing, because one way or another is going to lead me to success. I'm not too concerned about which path I take. And I think that equanimity is really, really valuable.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the way we deal with these, with the Klipot and the Golden Dawn is a very specific approach. Mm-hmm. And it ties into, yeah, exactly what you're saying there. Relevant to what I'm saying though, is occult perspectives. Here's comment on YouTube is cool. The Klifoth can be dangerous without a proper grounding. Universal Mastery YouTube channel goes into it extensively. Yes. So I noticed when I was chit-chatting on occult perspective or mm-hmm. this Brother Mason's channel, and mm-hmm. I was very respectful, of course, and just trying to have fun. Actually, the morning I woke up and mm-hmm. and got to it, I was like, oh, I'm gonna be a part of a live stream today and just didn't do that thing. I did that all morning with them, mm-hmm. and that was fun. I was tried to be as respectful, of course, as I could of the many Klifoth practitioners that were participating on that live stream, and it wasn't my channel, so I didn't really voice my opinion on things that would disparage their spirituality in any way. But you know, coming on my channel and asking me about the Klifoth and recommending me to a channel is great. I appreciate that, but I will also give my opinion. So here's my opinion: cool. I don't really have it in me. I haven't been able to find the wherewithal to take seriously any practitioner person who talks about the Klifoth as the Klifoth, or with like the Klifoth. It's not the word. It's they've changed the word, in my opinion, to speciate what they're doing from the Klipot and the Klipot's role in rabbinic Kabbalah, but as well as in Christian or Hermetic Kabbalah. So what I think has happened is a new form of approach to that, because it doesn't make any sense with the previous knowledge of the Klipot. It doesn't, for example, like track with the Book of Horns. And I find it really hard to get. My friends have loaned me a lot of the rarer Klifoth books so I could take a look at them and see if they were onto anything that I thought would be interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But these people, they don't learn Hebrew at all, for the most part, mm-hmm. it seems to mm-hmm. me. And so they don't read the Book of Horns, which is the mm-hmm. only way to read it, is with Hebrew. And mm-hmm. and so if you're not reading the main text on the Klifoth, on the Klipot, because I don't even know where the Klifoth came from. Klipot, Klipas is also good, or Klipa, but Klipot. Yeah. It's just, for sure. It's just, I'm interested in my understanding growing out of historical knowledge from masters of those traditions, from enlightened masters. We don't usually say enlightened much in the West, but, mm-hmm. you know, the rabbi who wrote the Book of Horns, you know, Chaim Smith might call him one of these sort of, you know, teachers who are ready to teach, masters who are ready to share some insights. And to me, I like my spirituality to grow out of this historical investigation and understanding of things. And I understand a lot of people in the so-called LHP community doing mm-hmm. the left-hand path thing and the Klifoth thing are mm-hmm. intentionally focusing more on personal gnosis and personal experience, and not even attempting to tie it into any previous historical understanding in any real way, as far as I can tell, and that's just evident from the sort of ahistoricism I see. And also the complete dismissal. Anytime I try and mention, like when I've tried to have conversations with them, we can't. And that's the definition of speciation, right? Yeah. That's why an AA member and a GD member are never going to have the same conversation about any of the ritual work they might do almost identically, because the context is completely different, right?
Mm-hmm, totally.
Just like, you know, if your context is to communicate with the Holy Guardian Angel, well, that's not a Golden Dawn thing. So you're no longer speaking in the same network of ideas as I am. If you're talking about true will, that's not a Golden Dawn thing. So again, there's no, mm-hmm. Those are barriers to communicate. And they were set up intentionally by Crowley to speciate, because without speciation, a group doesn't survive. His group wouldn't have survived if you could go back and integrate with the previous group and move back and forth. If you can move back and forth between those spheres, then they won't last, which is why I think the Cliffoth community that's really into that has had to become distinctly different in a way that is not reverse integratable to systems like the Golden Dawn or have, you know, especially Rabbinic Kabbalah. I would love to see people studying the Cliffoth more who engage with the actual Jewish sources. That would be cool. That would interest me, right? Again, these aren't value judgments. This is just talking about what interests me with my limited time in life. And so I really did like Kenneth Grant's book when I first read it. And so I can speak to that in Knox Asperk has asked me to speak to that. So yeah, that was very simple, a very simple study that I wasn't allowed to do at the time. So of course I did it being an edgy teenager. And you have to write a major paper, many major papers in my GD training. And so the one I wrote, so in Practicus, I shouldn't have been really diving into the Cleepo then, but also then in Portal, I went through Kenneth Grant's Nightside of Eden. And what I did was I discovered the tunnels and thought that was very cool. And me and my roommate at the time, Martin, spent many late nights all night long doing ritual work and then studying. And that was one of my main focuses, looking at the gematria and all those things. And what I discovered by studying the tunnels and in Kenneth Grant and the things, I used those insights from his gematria and other symbolism to look at the seven deadly sins and to look at an alignment of them on the Tree of Life that made sense to me based on my understanding of them, but also based on an understanding of the correspondences of the past. So that led to a different arrangement of the seven deadly sins on the Tree of Life than you might get if you were basing it on patristic sources or some of the early church fathers and their alignments of the sins, which are, you know, counterbalanced by the virtues, of course. So that came out differently when I took into consideration Grant's tunnels and tunnel demons, because I wanted them to line up with insights that you would get from the transmuting of those demons in the tunnels. What it wasn't was straight up path working, but of the tunnels. That's not what I was doing at all. That is not how we work with those things in the GD, really. You could, but I think there's better techniques, mainly using our inner order temple. Because that's where they're there. You don't have to invoke them at all. You don't have to evoke them. They're all there. And so you just, every time you're in there, you're working with them, whether you like it or not. And I think that's really the lesson of the Cleepode anyway. If you ever think you're free from dealing with the husks and the shells that you have to get through to get the wheat, then you've embodied a clip out yourself. You've become a husk and a shell, preventing yourself from getting to the wheat. That's an idea.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. And then where that text really came alive for me was the comparing of the insights from Kenneth Grant's Nightside of Eden with the insights from The Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross. So the fusion of those insights was revelatory. And so I started I gave a 6-hour lecture at one of our international GD events in 99. Mm-hmm. It was 98 on that. And it was a huge smash. So, the full day lecture, workshop going through each of them. And then I was it became demanded that I did those every international event. So that was, I was not an adept at that time. So I shouldn't have even been doing that. And I actually had to cut out a lot of all the Hebrew names of the Cleepot. I had to cut out a lot of the references to them for the Outer Order lectures, because that material just isn't meant to be looked upon even until a certain stage. So, but that was fun. But yeah, and then as I got higher in the grades and was brought into the Inner Order, I was able to give slightly more advanced lectures. But I didn't really focus on the Cleepot after that. After 5=6, once you step into Tiferet, you don't want to look down. You want to look up before you look down. And so then it was like, I'm just going to focus on angels, and my understanding of demons will progress in accordance with that. And that was that's the approach we would take. What I see now a lot happening, of course, is just, you know, the edgy thing where you just reverse it all and be like, the darkness is actually the light, and the light's actually the darkness. And a lot of people do that because it's very edgy, and that's fine. If I'm sure that can work as a spirituality for people in a certain for people for whom it works. Anyway, there you go.
Totally. So I have like four four things that I've been diligently memorizing as responses to everything you said just now. one on the last, I'll go through them in reverse order. On the last point of focusing upward, this is where I find it interesting, because the just having kind of a very rough map of what the impurities of the Sephirot are is useful for encountering any obstacles you have with integrating any of these spheres. Like if you're invoking Netzach, nothing seems to be happening, or it doesn't seem to be manifesting in the way that you expected. What's going on there? Sometimes looking into what are the impurities of Netzach, what are the obstacles you might have to incorporating this, that's where it becomes relevant. So I find in that upward focus, I think that's essential. We often find how these things are already present within us. And that ties into another point I wanted to make, which is what we said previously about more light revealing more dirt. you know, throwing the veil open and seeing, you know, the worst impurities of divine emanation all at once is probably a little bit overwhelming, probably a little bit more than you want to know, probably a little bit more than you're ready for necessarily at a certain point, especially when there's not just knowledge that comes with that. But for instance, having the Hebrew letters revealed to you, there can be an energetic transfer just in that, because the letters, the names themselves, it can be powerful formulae. And so having a more measured approach to accessing them and an upward focus is really good. At the same time, I'm way more sympathetic to left-hand practitioners than you for a couple of reasons. One, as far as the ahistoricism goes, I'm in the same boat. My practice was never super historical. One of the reasons that I got into Golden Dawn magic is that it's relatively new. and so there's not as much reliance on super ancient texts. There is a lot, but not as much as you'd find in like grimoire magic, where if it's not 500 years old, like forget about it. The authors that I studied in particular had made major alterations to the original Golden Dawn structure. By the time I got to it, it already been changed massively. When I started reading John Michael Greer, the Holy Guardian Angel was syncretized with the higher self. True will was a big part of it, and it continues to be for a lot of Golden Dawn practitioners. So like some of that stuff got reabsorbed just from the sheer popularity of Thelema, or however that respeciation happened. It came to me because I started studying the occult just to explain what was happening to me now in the present day. And so I wanted to hear from other people who were alive, authors who were alive, that were experiencing the same weird stuff that I'd experienced and that my friends and family had experienced, and were able to explain it. Like that was my number one goal. And historical texts to me were just useful reinforcement. Now, at the same time, especially talking to you, I've developed more and more appreciation for historical sources, because when you're trying to figure out why modern stuff doesn't make sense, you can trace the lineage back up the tree and figure out where was the source, where was this originally formed, and how did it speciate into all these various versions, and why do these two things not make sense anymore? And you can actually use history to solve a lot of the problems that you find in modern magic. So I've come around on that, but I understand people that have an ahistorical take to the magical practice, because that's how I started. And then the other thing is that left-hand practitioners are less interested in tracing out the klippot from its Hebrew origins than just inverting Christian iconography into a workable system of religion. They want whatever their religion is to be the exact opposite of what Christianity is, whatever that is in their imagination. You want to go to say?
And by doing that, they're actually taking a rabbinic thing, an element, and Christianizing it to invert the Christianity. So they're actually involved in what is essentially a Christian project. Any left-hand path are doing that, because they have to extract it from the Judaism, Christianize it, thus to invert it.
Yeah.
So they're actually, you could actually call them, another word for the cliffothic practitioners of that species on the left-hand path, you could actually just refer to them as Christian cliffothic proselytizers. because they want you to look at, if they want you to look at the cliff oath in this way, first you need to accept Christianity and then you need to extract the cliff oath from Judaism and then flip it on its head. And there's your system. And that's, I think that's delightful. I mean, yeah, it's not for me, but I love it. I just love what's happening in that process of events. Yeah.
No, it's interesting. I don't think any left-hand practitioner would appreciate being called a Christian capitalist, but it is technically true.
They've accidentally turned themselves into Christian capitalists in the process of engaging the clip out to invert Christianity or something. And we're obviously speaking general terms, and people can put their hands up if this applies to them. It's fascinating. It's no more wild and crazy than anything else that's really happened in the last 100 years of magic and mysticism, if you ask me. And when I do refer to historical sources about the clipothic stuff, I'm not referring to as far back even as the Zohar necessarily. I'm talking about like even just as far back as the Golden Dawn and that approach. So it's like, or the Kenneth Grant approach, which again, I'm just not incredibly familiar with that stuff. The interesting thing I want to say about your pointing out the speciation of a true will and holy guardian angel and how it's been remerged with the Golden Dawn. Well, what's interesting about that is that it's possible. Because it does still come from the GDE tradition, right? True will is Chia, right? In the Golden Dawn, we focus on Neshama, Chia, and Yechida. Those are where we focus on. It's almost like Crowley said, but Chia is going to be the main thing. The will aspect will be what we focus on. And it's and again, he knew how to market. He knew what would catch on. I often think his true will was actually just to create so much of a hullabaloo that magic couldn't be dismissed entirely for the next 100 years and given a chance to have this kind of a revolution that we're enjoying so much. And he put it on the front page of a lot of things, including album covers and songs. And now we have Boleskine being rebuilt. Those people are awesome. I've talked a lot to those people the last week. And, you know, they sent us a rock. They sent us a rock for our as a donation to our conference, which is very cool. Thank you.
That's amazing.
It's so cool that they would do that. So, and the Holy Guardian Angel, of course, is a text Mathers translated for a reason, right? It was absolutely intended for Adepts in the Golden Dawn to do that at, usually most people say the 6-5 stage. That's when you would engage with that sort of along with the Goetia, because the Abramelin is very much aimed at giving you the tools to work with the Goetia. I mean, that's part of how the process works. Spoiler warning. You can talk about a true will in the Golden Dawn, and it's not actually uncomfortable. We're talking about Chia in that sense. But if you replace Yechida with Chia, then we're not having the same conversation. And if you talk about Abramelin, it's a grimoire. We can absolutely talk about that.
No, well, that's interesting to me because, like Mathers tried to integrate it into the Golden Dawn system along with Enochian magic and a bunch of other magic, because the Golden Dawn was just this great project of syncretization, trying to take all the world's spiritual wisdom and put it all in one system, in one place. The interesting thing for me is that a number of people that I know who started off either in the AA or practicing Golden Dawn magic did the Abramelin and completely stopped doing any kind of Golden Dawn style or Thelema style ceremonial magic and went straight into grimoire magic from that point on. And that just became their primary tool for accessing the divine. So it's interesting to see, you know, the attempt to integrate it with the number of people who have had the opposite effect having successfully done the ritual. Oh, Prada, you're muted.
You mentioned Mathers integrating the Abramelin with the Golden Dawn. That never happened. He just translated the book. But it was never mandated in the curriculum as far as anyone I know knows. And the letters, one of the ways we know learn a lot of the stuff that people don't realize is knowable is by reading letters from these people, right? And the thing, seeing what they reference. Like, that's how we know that Crowley's scrying the aethers method is just a Golden Dawn technique he learned from Mathers. And that's why Crowley's aether scrying is so interesting to GDE people, because it's the only testament to that Golden Dawn practice being employed
Oh, wow.
That we have left. The others were burned because GD people generally burn all their stuff and burn all their temporal stuff. It's I think it's ridiculous and tragic, but whatever. They're like, yep, it's dying with us. Not for you, motherfuckers, just for us. We created this beautiful thing and we're taking it with us. Just like your grandparents and your inheritance.
That's a tragedy, but thank you. That's interesting. I've heard some references to it being done or signed in the portal grade, so I wasn't sure if that was
I mean, these days there's people doing that, and I think that's kind of exciting. I could talk about that, but I'm not allowed. But there's definitely people doing all kinds of stuff in orders and order training and improving it too. I've said too much. Okay, so I will say, but the other, and the Enochian, now that's an interesting point, and that sort of ties in. We got a couple questions I think we could probably answer before wrapping this thing up, hopefully.
Sure, sure.
I see you, Cryo and Nox. And the Enochian wasn't integrated into the Golden Dawn because of Mathers in any way, shape, or form. I mean, he did most of the work on the material, especially the early material, for sure. With Westcott, but mostly it was Mathers and the spirits helping him, of course. Mm-hmm. But the Enochian, everyone likes to think that Golden Dawn Enochian is something that the Golden Dawn created. No, even the separating of the tablets and the coloring of the tablets and the way to use the tablets for the initiations to bring in the elemental forces, because the GD initiations are powered by many things. But according to the source text, the main thing that powers them would seem to be the Enochian watchtowers, the elemental watchtowers, as they called them there, because of their coloring. And that coloring was all presented in the Cypher manuscript. So all the Enochian was already there. The way the Hierophant traces symbols, the pentagrams and the scepters, all of that was already compiled in the Cypher manuscript. So that's why people forget that this is the Golden Dawn is a system based off the Cypher manuscripts.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of that stuff comes from there, which means it was written down by someone else based on their understanding of the grimoires and grimoiric magic too. Some master, probably Hockley or one of his friends in Germany, maybe like someone associated with Franz Hartmann or one of the other founders of the OTO, original OTO. I mean, that was Hartmann and Kerner and Steiner was a member for a while, and Memphis Mizraim groups were closely associated with it. So, the Enochian was. And the initiations and stuff, that's pre-Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn Enochian magic is pre-Golden Dawn.
Wow. I did not know that.
It comes from somewhere else. And that is one of the, many avenues that people just don't even explore anymore. The main text to explore that in, of course, is published as Practical Angel Magic. So, there was this 9,000-word D document of prayers that over the course of somewhere over a period of 100, 150 years or something like that, maybe more, we don't know exactly when, someone added an extra 90,000 words to it and fleshed it out massively. And that manuscript is, Skinner has that published as Practical Angel Magic, with a theory of the lineage of angel magic practitioners from D directly up all the way to the Golden Dawn. What the Golden Dawn used for their Concourse of Forces book H is just a tiny fragment of that data, and it's shown in its original form in the back. Matt, they fleshed out their system with the, True and Faithful Relation and all the other manuscripts in the museum. And that's how Mathers wrote the GD Enochian system. And GD Enochian composed of three lessons that Mathers wrote, only one of which survives, which is the lesson on the watchtowers, on the parts, working with the watchtowers. The papers on the 7 days, it was called, I think, something like the 7 days of creation. Nick Farrell talks about this in his great books, Beyond the Sun and King Over the Waters. I don't remember which, but probably Beyond the Sun, which everyone should read. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the 7 days of creation was the heptarchial lesson, and then the scrying and traveling the aethers was Mather's approach to the aethers, and that is something that then Crowley explored and made famous and turned into the famous Vision in the Voice book that it is, and very interesting. I mean, he went the other direction too. He started at the end. And went back to the beginning, whereas traditionally you would start at Lil and go to Tex, following Hebrew rabbinic Hechelot practices and Merkava mysticism. And that's the Golden Dawn way, of course, as well. And it doesn't come from Mathers. It comes from the Cipher manuscripts, invoking always from the highest. So you start with Lil, just like we always start with the Ataluthic divine name, right? El Tzadkiel Hashmalim. And then this, then the intelligence governing the evil spirit, you know, of the Sphera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So those are my two thoughts on that. Well, here's a question from Cryo. I've had some entity dreams and a couple visions, but never any tangible response from a spirit. Any ideas how to promote contact? Over to you, Marcus.
Yeah. So this is, it's funny that you're fielding, giving this question to Mediafield. The easiest way to have a more intense contact with spirit is through evocation, which I do not practice. I do not teach. I do not especially recommend. If you do enough invocations, you may have spirits invoke themselves. That can be scary, but it can also be very beneficial if they are good spirits and you've been aligning yourself with good forces and you have the development of your magical senses in order to be able to experience this stuff. When I've had spirits evoke themselves to me, it's shown up as kind of a dense mist and a figure standing somewhere. It's something that you can say you can see it with your eyes, but it's not exactly with your physical eyes. It's a distortion that it's a distortion in consciousness that shapes your physical perception. That's the most technical way I can explain it. But that's how I've experienced spirits showing up in an etheric body before me. But I've never tried to do that. And the reason is that there's a lot of precautions that come with evocation. And at least from what I've read of John Michael Greer's work, doesn't always work with angels necessarily. A lot of evocation comes with elementals, lesser spirits, and the difficulties of working with spirits that have their own personal autonomy and that are not fully connected with the divine is that they may not like you. They may not treat you kindly if you are forcing them into a physical form, into a reality that they're not essentially comfortable with, just so that you can have an experience. It's not necessarily going to work out for you. And if you try to double down by asking them, you know, something enormously ambitious to give you as a gift, and you're not thinking about anything to offer in return, then that could go even more poorly. So evocation is not something that I especially practice or want to do. It's something that happens. But if you're looking for a more vivid experience of spirits, I would really just focus on daily invocations, trying to visualize things as vividly as possible. Seeing things in your mind's eye is underrated, especially since once spirits start to communicate with you, then you can have things that appear in your mind's eye that you can go and verify. Like, you can learn information that you can go and look up. You can learn things that are going to happen in the future. You can learn things that you wouldn't have thought to do, and then you do them and you succeed. And those forms of verified gnosis are really powerful and affirming, even if you don't have this really vivid, visceral, physical experience of a spirit manifesting itself. So if you're looking for a very vivid phenomena, the ways that I know of getting it aren't necessarily recommendable. I would more focus on invocation, visualization, and also communication. I think communication is kind of the underrated thing. I spent a lot of time talking to my spirits. When I started doing the LBRP in my first year, I would sometimes spend an hour just talking to the spirits as I called them in, talking to the angels as I called them in. So I think communication and learning to use your psychic senses and visualization to correspond with spirits is perhaps the way to get started experiencing phenomena, because then you will find words coming that are not from you, that can give you insight into your life, that can be useful, that can be verified gnosis. And that's about as intense a phenomenon as you really want to experience at the beginning. Because the other problem I have, you know, teaching people magic is that they call me freaking out because they physically saw an angel. And I tell them, what did you think was going to happen? You've been invoking angels every day for months now. And you're surprised when one of them wants to talk to you instead of you making the call. Like, this happens. So a lot of people that are looking for that confirmation of visceral physical phenomena often are not prepared for it in ways that they don't fully realize. So for all of those reasons, I'd really focus on just invoking every day, talking to the spirits and having, you know, good communications as much as you can, and kind of taking it slow from there. Because again, you don't want to rend the veil open all at once. You don't necessarily want to have an experience that you're not prepared for. And the tract of, you know, self-initiated Golden Dawn magic is really good for gradually opening you up to those experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Invoke often and inflame thyself with prayer, as prayer, the Chaldean oracles advise us. Or maybe it's the Esh Metzadef. I don't remember if it's the oracles or the Esh Metzadef, the purifying fire. Those are two. That and the Hermetic Arcanum are the three documents we had to also write papers on to get out of Philosophus, I think, if I recall. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So, invoke often, inflame yourself with prayer. I would also say focus is very important. Like if you're casting a broad net, that might work, but you may as well rock back and forth and then say, I invoke all spirits and become a playground of forces you cannot control. So probably better to focus on building I think that's a lot of what the important message behind having nativity angels or holy angels assigned to us by our birth is about, is an indictment to focus on those specific spirits before any others, right? Like, get to know your own angels first before you you do more. Someone asks, welcome Glenn, can you overdo the LRP? There's the idea, if you banish nonstop it without invoking, there's the idea that you can demagnetize your aura. I don't know of anyone who's ever experienced that happening to them. I've seen people say that they notice something, but yeah, I was doing Don Craig's book, you're invoking pretty quickly with other rituals, just not the LBRP. You're doing the LBRP, not the LIRP. So, yeah, and in the GD, then we started with, we did the LBRP and Neophyte, but then as soon as you get into Zillator, it was LIRP as well. And I think that was just to not overwhelm people. You know, you're only meant to spend a month to 3 months in Neophyte anyway before you memorize the 100 answers for the test and stuff. But in general, it's like saying, can you overdo prayer, in my opinion? So if you're doing LIRP in the morning and LBRP in the evening, I don't think you can really overdo that.
To me, it's there is a worry of getting spaced out at a certain point. This is interesting. So one of the reasons that, you know, it's called the Hermetic tradition, hermits, these people who are working with Hermes, this god of communication and knowledge and information and teaching, would go into caves and completely isolate themselves from society in order to connect with divinity. That doesn't make super intuitive sense. But a lot of times you needed that lack of stimulation in order to listen to spiritual forces, in order to connect with these beings. And I think that sometimes the more connected you get to these beings, the more disconnected you get to the mass consciousness of regular society. Now, to a certain extent, that's healthy. Modern society is not particularly healthy, I think, by anybody's estimation. So a certain amount of distance from that is the idea. But if you get so distant from it that you have trouble understanding people, have trouble talking to people, that you're isolated from people, then, you know, lay off it. But also, that's not going to happen all at once. That's going to be something that you notice gradually if you do magic obsessively. And then you just know, oh, I can take a day off. I can take a little bit off. But actually, for particularly self-initiation, I actually encourage people to try for that result to see if they can overwhelm themselves by banishing too much, by invoking too much of a certain element, by finding their limits within each of these forces. Because to me, it's like weightlifting. You lift as much as you can lift. You find out how much that is. And you also expand your capacity at the same time. And so if you can do that, if you can find your limits of how much of each of these forms of magic is comfortable for you, because they're daily rituals, because they're very gradual, you can back off once you hit to a point where it starts to feel like too much, and just expand your knowledge of each of these techniques and figure out what are they actually doing to you.
I absolutely agree with that approach. That is distinctly, I think you might even say, a Golden Dawn approach.
Yeah.
Is this because it came out of that mentality of this is the occult sciences. So, you know, make notes and try it. And my attitude towards most things in life is that of any, it's just like any other veteran musician. When we get a suggestion, my response is, let's try it. And sometimes that can go very badly. And, you know, if you've heard from other people not to try things, you might take their advice, their wisdom, and claim it as your own. But yeah, finding limits is good. The question here is, if you banish too much, it shuts down. This person experiences that it shuts down operations that are currently working. I'm going to make an assumption about what is meant there, because if you're banishing, that's an operation. I'm not sure what other operations you're doing at the same time as banishing. Yeah. But I think they mean the results of other workings. And if doing an LBRP shuts down all the spirits that are involved in your life, well, you're a god. You're more powerful than God. So I don't think that's what's doing it. What I think might be happening is something in your own intentionality and the context that you're creating, the paradigm in which you're doing these things. If you're, you're banishing, are you focusing on all the things you're trying to call to you and invoke? All right. That would be weird. You wouldn't want to do that. Focus is important. And if you're banishing too much and you find it shuts things down, I mean, stop hitting yourself, essentially. Yeah. You know, why are you hitting yourself? Don't do that. We move talismans we've newly made out of the circle before we do an LBRP, just as a precaution. Mm-hmm. But the LBRP is not this thing designed to affect the macrocosm so much. Yeah. It's a microcosmic ritual. The lesser hexagram ritual is microcosmic as well. It's the supremes that affect the macrocosm, and they only do so in the Golden Dawn system once you've been crowned with, you know, the 5-6 initiation and done the equivalent of what people think is knowledge and conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel, but actually takes a very different form through the initiation. And you know, if you want to spoil it for yourself, anyone can go read that and see there's no Holy Guardian Angel mentioned or anything like that. No true will mentioned, really. I mean, that language is sometimes in there because it comes out of the GD. So that makes sense, right? You know, you want to get in touch with those forces.
Yeah, I would say that it could be a watcher on the threshold issue. I find that people have an aversion to banishing the same way they might have an aversion to cleaning, just in terms of letting things go. And if your mind is coming up with reasons to not banish, then that could be one of them. but that's the only other explanation I can feel for, I can imagine for that scenario. As you're saying, I don't experience the LBRP working in that way at all. I find it to be very much focused on, as you said, the microcosm, cleaning up yourself, cleaning up your immediate environment, and just doing that with the energies.
Yeah, like we're told to do an LBRP before we do any other work in a space we've not done rituals in before, right? To clear it out. But normally, I would only do the LBRP if I'm unbalanced, right? Golden Dawn approaches to everything is about balancing. It's how we even transmute the clipboat. Right? It's always through balance, always through returning to that point of light, which is in the center of our foreheads, right? That we focus on, that's in the center of our gem in the 5-6. It's the center of the ceiling. It's this point of light we always keep returning to, the center of the triangle. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so when you're doing the lesser ritual, the pentagram, in either case, you're uniting with the light of Yehida, right? Mm-hmm. You're either tracing from Earth, bringing Earth up to Spirit, up to Kether. Yeah. You're bringing Malkut up to Kether with a banishing, or bringing Kether down to Malkut with an invoking. Either way, you're uniting heaven and Earth.
Yes.
So anything that shouldn't be in your life should be gone purified to some extent with the divine white brilliance of the light of the crown as you connect your crown with your body. So that's what you're doing with that tracing. This is my interpretation of that symbolism. Other aspect of it I think that's important is, hopefully it didn't slip my mind, Yeah. So if I go do my ritual shower before my rituals, mm-hmm. and I get yeah. out, I put on my robe. Mm-hmm. If I feel good after that, if I'm not unbalanced or distracted, mm-hmm. or if nothing's nagging at me, I'm just in a great state, ready to do my mm-hmm. work. I've prepared myself fully and haven't mm-hmm. gotten any disturbing news that I allowed to affect me, or mm-hmm. you know, I didn't stub my toe on the way while drying off. Then I wouldn't do an LBRP at all. I would just do mm-hmm. an LIRP because I'm in a good place to bring in the light. And they both bring in the light and both protect you sort of equally anyway. And in both times, you're doing the evocation of the archangels, and they're yeah. always like mm-hmm. having them face outward for the LBRP was a mistake. That was a mistake I think Craig introduced.
Yeah.
And they should always be facing inward. And that, when I found that out, I was like, this is way better. Yeah, I like that. Like mm-hmm. the angels are always facing inward. And I like to do extend the LIRP operation in a lot of ways. Like afterwards, I might close my eyes after the final Kabbalistic cross, or even before the final Kabbalistic cross, mm-hmm. and see if there's any of the spirit of the four angels are calling to me, and then I'll go or rotate clockwise, always clockwise, mm-hmm. to face them and do the appropriate grade sign or salute them in some other way. Mm-hmm. And if people don't want to use GD grade signs as mudras, I totally get it. That's a lovely thing, respect you're showing to the tradition. Mm-hmm. But mudras are powerful. So yeah. maybe use the mudras in Poke Runyon books. You know, he was one of the early teachers we had in our order back mm-hmm. in 97. I got to have him for a day giving lectures down in LA. And so I like his sort of the way he brings things together. He has a lot of different takes on things. Someone saying Allah is the truth. Yeah, sure. Why not? Definitely a lowercase t truth, that's for sure. I mean, that's very Jacques Lacan or Alain Badiou. There is no capital T truth, just the subjective truths of locality, sure.
But is there anything else you wanted for this live stream before we wrap up, Frater?
No, I guess I tried to segue with the Boleskin door prize donation to InnokiaCon, but I'm excited to do InnokiaCon. There's only a few days left for people till the 4th of April to get the 3-month payment plan. If anyone's interested in that, you can go to InnokiaCon.com or ArcaneResearchSociety.com and sign up for InnokiaCon. If you can't come in person, we'll still attend online and help us make these events kick off and happen, and that would be a really wonderful thing. Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I'm excited to travel to Vancouver, see you in person, see all of the other people that will be attending there in person. It's going to be an amazing time. So yeah, anybody listening to this or watching this, buy your tickets. It's going to be awesome.
Knox Asperk asks, Marcus, I know you do classes. Do you have any books? They're right behind him and behind him on the shelf. That's not what he meant.
You're muted. I'm working on it. I'm relatively new to the occult scene. I've been busy becoming a full-time teacher. I have my current course on the tools of magic. That will be opening again. I'll be doing another round of that in the August-September timeframe. If you'd like to book a meeting with me to have a one-on-one and pick my brain and talk about magic, and see what we can do to prepare you for that course, you can go to marcusmatter.com to book a session with me.
And I have a little outro thing for us, a little thing that you and I could even learn from this. This is very cool. So, you know, the Emerald Tablet, right? That chunk of rock, which Thoth brought from Atlantis. Well, that's actually the rock Boleskin is sending us now. So the Emerald Tablet has another name, and I've always mispronounced it. Do you know the Emerald Tablet's other true name?
No.
In Latin?
No.
Well, I always thought it was pronounced like something like, you know, my Latin's not perfect, but like Tabula Smaragdina. But apparently, I have an expert on the line here who's going to pronounce it properly for us, and this will be a fun little learning lesson for all of us before we sign off here on this debut guest test live stream with this new software. So it looks like this is the big announcement. Actually, essentially, my podcast from now on out will be live streamed live. I always said to my guests, look, we're recording on Zoom as if live. I won't edit and just upload the full file, and they're like, okay, well, now it will actually be live. So yeah, I have the We have the tools. We can build it. So here we go. We have a special expert here, world famous, to teach us the correct pronunciation of the Emerald Tablet's name.
Smaragdine tablet, or the tabula smaragdina. Boy, I fucked that up.
Occult insights of Mr. Joe Rogan. Thank you.
How awesome was that?
I was not expecting that.
That's so awesome.
It's a great way to wrap up.
I knew I wouldn't be able to. I basically never watched Joe Rogan anymore. He used to have guests on that I really liked, but not so much these days. Occasionally. And I certainly couldn't get through the Cat Williams one. Just it's a little too wild for me. But I'm glad I checked out a little bit of it and discovered them. Cat Williams introducing Joe Rogan to Hermeticism and the Hermetica. So that was very cool. You'd think he would know more about it with Duncan Trussell talking about magic here and there all the time. But, you know, people, he's friends with Maynard and hasn't even gone to see Tool yet. So I have little hope that his tastes will improve in this lifetime. But yeah, at least he's getting into the Emerald Tablet. That's good to see. So that's how you pronounce it, folks. That was me making sure that I actually had figured out how to share videos while live streaming. So I had that sorted out for you.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I have Joe Rogan to thank for finding golden on magic. I was practicing Druidry before then. No kidding, right? He had Duncan Trussell, and he played the clip from Midnight Gospel with Damien Eccles. And that's how I found Damien Eccles and Golden Dawn Magic. I'm like, oh, I'm going to drop everything and do this. And that completely worked my life. So, thanks to Joe.
I started this Golden Dawn podcast a month before that Midnight Gospel came out. So it was very good timing. But that didn't even occur to me because, I don't know, lockdowns were rough. Yeah, this was fun. We should do this very much again. And thanks for watching, everybody. We had up to 20 people here for quite a while, and now we're down to 14 as we sign off, which is just awesome. Right. I haven't figured out how to do all the commands and functions yet, like have us on. Anyway, I'll figure it out. Yes. So happy Easter, everyone.
Happy Easter.
Christi Anesti, Christos Anesti, Kyrie Eleison. And have a beautiful, beautiful little holiday day. And I've got to get ready for class here in 45 minutes. So, you can find me at hermeticpodcast.com. You can become a patron for $7. That really helps, actually. Patrons really would help. Or you can attend my weekly classes or join free. You can join free. Join my Cyber Guild free. We have really cool guest presenters coming up on my Cyber Guild this year, like really cool guests, because I've got, I'm actually doubling down on that whole guest presenter thing for the Cyber Guild, because your last one was so much fun, and people can go to join the Cyber Guild and watch it for free. You can watch Marcus Mattern give a very stern, hard talk that might give some of you some ideas about how to improve your practice by confronting your own iniquities. Oh. I always love those tough love talks. Tough love talks are good, because they always say, you're always tough. You should be tough on yourself, but you might miss things, because we always miss things about ourselves. But then when you hear someone else talk about the things they're tough on themselves about, you might be like, I give myself a total pass on that one. Maybe I should floss.
Yeah.
And, something like that.
Totally. Yeah, and I find that it doesn't get talked about enough sometimes. So it was really great to give a talk that I was really excited to give and have a great time at the Cyber Guild. So yeah, everyone join Fred RC's free Cyber Guild and see talks like mine and other cool new guest presenters in the future. And thank you so much for watching.
And right before we go,
Smaragdine tablet, or the tabula smaragdina. Boy, I fucked that up.
Brilliant.
All right, goodbye, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Thanks. God bless.
Diving deep into the practices and reality tunnels of the esoteric and the occult, check out Praxis Behind the Obscure podcast, where I interview practicing occultists, do book reviews, and much more. check us out on YouTube, Red Circle, and many other podcast platforms.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a six-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new Grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.
Join us in person or online for Canada's only occult conference. Visit Vancouver in beautiful British Columbia and help us leave lockdowns behind us and get back to life. The first of four Dee and Kelly conferences over the next 4 years support the Arcane Research Society in bringing excellence in academic scholarship and practical knowledge from some of the best scholars and occultists in the field. Featuring in 2024 this summer, Dr. Terry Burns, translator of Dr. John Dee's famous Monus Hieroglyphica. Dr. Burns has just completed a 52-video course on this mystical text, which you can watch on YouTube for free. Join us and experts Rufus Opus, P.D. Newman, J. Allen Moore, Daniel Rekshan, Frater R.C., and more for this exciting event, which will explore the angelic and spirit-filled world of Elizabethan mages, Dr. John Dee, and the alchemist Sir Edward Kelly. Learn the secrets of drawing spirits into crystals, conjuration, and Enochian angel magic, as well as the role of dreams and their connections to these other extra-dimensional realities and alchemical transformation. Sign up today to attend online or in person at enochiacon.com, presented by the Arcane Research Society.